I'm going to make three suggestions and see what your response is to this business.
Okay.
Of these patterns of affection or patterns, actually, again, as I think of these, some of these are affections because clearly we want to say something like this, you feel awe and wonder. But truthfulness is much more like a virtue. It's you don't necessarily feel truthful today, although some of you might. Usually if you feel truthful, it doesn't work out so well because truthfulness is hard work. But delight you certainly do feel. So the thing I want to add here just before I make my three points is that this is a mixture of things. These finally become ways of living. To live gratefully doesn't mean that you're feeling grateful at time T1 and time T2 and time T3. In fact, going back to my dear friend Walt McFarland of blessed memory, when he waited on his wife for 14 years, you can't very well be immediately feeling grateful for a bedpan, can you? I mean, when you go through a lot of that kind of stuff, gratitude has to be deeper than the immediate feeling. So that does lead me to my kind of first point I want to make, suggestion. Sometimes it's important for us to feel the emotions. But that's only one thing we do. Emotions also become motives. And playing on the old etymology of the word emotion, motions of the soul. So in any of these cases and in others, I want to suggest that every congregation ought to be able to feel its joy and feel its thankfulness and feel awe and wonder. But we can't let it simply stay at the level of feeling because these are deeper patterns. For example, if we added the term grief, perhaps under lament, but on its own, all of you fully know that to feel grief can take very complicated forms. And sometimes grief is the absence of all feeling, isn't it? Absolute dumbness, absolute nothing. I mean, connected with being depressed. But grief also can be felt as rage, can't it? And anger. So what I'm suggesting here is feeling our emotions is important from time to time, but that isn't the ultimate goal of arousing these states of being. The real goal is to live gratefully, to live with the capacity for awe and wonder, to live truthfully insofar as we can, to have the capacity to grieve deeply, but also to rejoice. And in fact, our language gives us some access here because instead of feeling joy, if we rejoice in something, it's much more like a sustained activity, isn't it? For example, if you are a collector of postage stamps, I'm just going to give you a silly example, and you've looked all your life for the 22-cent upside-down biplane, partly because it's worth $90,000 or something, there would be the great feeling of joy when you discovered that stamp. You'd been searching for it for years. But the enjoyment of stamp collecting is not dependent upon that episode of joy over the one stamp. Wow. The enjoyment is the continuing activity of it. And so there's the several levels of these things. And that's the first point I wanted to make, that it is very important. I mean, for example, it's like any relationship you have, a married relationship, a deep friendship, a companionship, you know, love's a fire, but it won't take out the garbage. Or maybe we ought to say it the other way around. Love is not always a fire. Sometimes it takes out the garbage. And so, but when the relationship falls cold, and when the relationship becomes taken for granted, and is there a soul in this room that does not have that happen to him or her? Then you want to say, hey, once more with feeling, please. Don't just say, I love you, or da-dee-da-dee, show me. So it's important, I think, from time to time to have, as we say, enlivened experiences. A Bach everywhere, Bach. Enlivened experience of these things. But that isn't the be-all and end-all. So, what's the liturgical upshot of that? Don't aim simply at arousing feeling or expressing feeling. The liturgy has deep feeling in it. Those prayers, those texts, those hymns we sing, and we rarely plumb the depths of the emotion. But sometimes the emotion is more shown in the way a person lives than in how they're feeling. And sometimes people have you ever had this experience? Oh, I felt so great. I felt it was such a great, it was an enormous, it was a powerful experience. Yes, and nothing ever came of it. All they have is the memory of having experienced something powerful. But I think the faith is different. If one experiences something powerfully, then there's going to be a trajectory. So I think in a culture, let me put it this way, this is the second point I wanted to make. In our culture, it's becoming exceedingly difficult to distinguish between immediacy of feeling and depth of emotion over time. In our culture, it's becoming more difficult to distinguish between immediacy of feeling, I'm feeling it, are you feeling it, we're all feeling it, and depth of emotion over time. It will be like the Walt McFarland who stayed with it. It will be like the joy in the midst of tribulation. It'll be the grateful heart, come what may. And truthfulness against all the odds. So the difference between immediacy of feeling, feeling it right now, and depth of emotion over time. And I think the culture of hype, may I characterize it that way? I think we live in a culture of hype. Tends then to push worship in that direction. Now, please don't misunderstand me. I want people to feel something, for heaven's sakes. Are you alive or dead? Sometimes, you know, you get up there and you want to say, is there anybody here? Is there anybody here? Is there anybody? You know?
I was just thinking that I think that's an area where we need to be careful as worship planners and worship leaders, because we can very easily work our people up into, yeah, with the right song and right rhythm into a state of joy, or we can find the right tearjerker song or video to manipulate people's emotions. And I think it's real important that we don't manipulate our people's emotions, but you know, through the Spirit of God, we celebrate God's work in people's lives in a way that does stretch those emotions out, but like you said, heads for formation.
Yeah. I think that's absolutely right, and it's the second heresy, the business of manipulation, because we can do a lot to manipulate people, and we are being manipulated, folks, by the culture, immensely. I mean, we're all supposed to have, especially males, 27-year-old abs eternally. Are we not? And if you buy this dress, you do this thing, yeah, some of us have it. Buy this car and you'll have this identity. I mean, it's enormous. Sort of this. What we do is set the conditions under which the Spirit of God may come to a community and form us in these things over time. I keep using that phrase, I guess, against my own self, over time. Again, the point that you were making this morning. It's going to take some formative time. I mean, like a marriage, you know, it's not all honeymoon, is it? But any deep friendship that suffers rupture and is recovered, this is something. The third thing I wanted to say, the first was about the nature of the emotions themselves. The second was about this question of we live in a culture which puts pressure on Christian worship to be a certain kind of hyped up place. Now, look, if you're dead in the water, I mean, if we're talking about a parish that doesn't feel anything ever, and they dare you to make them feel, then I'd be just cussed enough to want to turn up the tremolo. Get the snare drums out or something. I mean, there are these places that are just sort of dead, you know. So don't misunderstand me there. But I think our basic problem is in a culture of hype, is that we don't see that we're in the long haul of formation, of character, of disposition. Stan Hauerwas is very good at this. Old friend of mine. His vocabulary is different from mine, if you've ever heard his adjectives. East Texas adjectives. Sometime over dinner, late at night, I'll tell you the story. But anyway, the third thing is maybe now the obvious thing and what I want to spend the last 25 minutes or so on. I think each of these show up in every worship service, whether it's a preaching service, or word and table, word and Eucharist, or healing, or as Bob was saying, funeral service. And one would hope that they would show up in every single kind of service that we do. Part of our problem here is that we often don't think through from beginning to end and then backwards about what the emotional valences are of the things we're using. That's a fancy way of saying one interesting way of planning a worship service is to think backwards, is to think from the blessing at the end and the benediction backwards through. And that will give you a little different perspective about what is linking with what. It isn't the only way to think about that, but it's one. Now, the other thing that's implied here is that these are also not something you're going to get full scale in every service. But only over time will these things open up. And now we're back to the question of the cycles of time. The morning prayer does something that a Eucharistic service doesn't pray, say, do. A healing service is different from a preaching service as such, etc., etc., etc. One of the things we've done is shrink everything to sort of one kind of expectant pattern. Sunday morning has had to bear the burden, an awful burden, of being everything to everybody. There was an earlier sociological time when we had our Wednesday night prayer meetings. I was in Korea recently, and I was surprised that they've held on to Wednesday night prayer meetings and Sunday prayer meetings. And those have a very different character than Sunday morning. So we've kind of lost something sociologically, in especially in urban life, but also in rural life, too. So in a way, what we ought to do is rethink over a period of time what variety of patterns of liturgy are we offering. Now, blessed are you if you can offer some form of morning prayer or evening prayer, even if it's in houses, people's houses. Some of the best experiences recently I've had have been celebrating a brief evening prayer around at a common meal with groups, small, as it were, small ecclesiole, little house gatherings. And in one case, it was in Nashville actually, no one had experienced an evening prayer service. They thought the Anglicans had the corner on that. So we used a little form in this worship book, but invited people to someone's house for dinner. But before the dinner was served, we had the lighting of the evening lamps, and someone got up and read early text on the lucernarium. Why do we do this? Well, you know, and we sing, and the food tasted so much better, and the conversation was so different. And people went away saying, gee, what made the difference tonight? And then finally they understood. It's because we had this sense of doing something ancient at the beginning of this gathering. So check this out. First question is, in a given Sunday service, these dimensions are there. How are they there? And some of them can be more prominent than others, obviously. But But the more important question is, what varieties of service carry these things? And over time, shouldn't our congregation have a richer diet of these patterns? That's why I was very pleased about that dissertation on the use of the love feast, or the agape. That's, for many of the churches that I have been into, that's either unknown or not practiced, or very infrequently practiced. There are times where we gather for worship that are special. I think of Christmas Eve services. Why is it? What about that? It's a very different time. People are, you know, coming back in the evening is a very different experience than Sunday morning. So I invite you to think of types of services, patterns of liturgy, not just the standard Sunday morning one, that can form people and give expression to Christian life over time that you may not have done, that you might want to try. And then I would want to distinguish, not really big metaphysical way, the difference between our standard services, like preaching services, preaching in the Eucharist, or this, and what I would call para-liturgical gatherings. That's a fancy word for saying they aren't meant to be, in the first instance, competitors with our standard, say, Sunday Lord's Day service. But here I'm thinking now of such things as informal hymn sings, table prayer, sung table prayer, where you think through singing. It might be with familiar hymns, it might be with a couple of Taizé songs, at a movement. A simple daily office at a meeting can change the character of a committee meeting. You know, think of those possibilities of gathering and doing a 15-minute prayer office before the finance committee, before the pastoral committee, or whatever. One of the favorites of mine is having folks join, if you do have a choir, having folks come, treat the choir to a meal, and then have a session with congregation and choir, where the choir teaches the congregation something new. That's, I found a lot of hope in that, and I found some good response to that. Does this make sense then? What I'm really inviting is, to use another term entirely we haven't used yet, the ecology of the worship life of a given congregation can be richer than it is if we look for the right places and the right kind of variety of experiences. And the right variety of liturgical patterns and non sort of para liturgical. Another wonderful thing I love to do, of course, is a hymn festival, but that takes work, as you musicians well know. But you know, some really wonderful things can happen when people hear the stories and some good exegesis of hymn texts. Really can. That could even happen on a Sunday morning. Think of Bach, all those darn cantatas based on scripture through the year. Goodness gracious. Well, don't compare ourselves with Bach. That has a couple of disadvantages. He was one of a kind and we aren't. and his Luther tradition saw a cantata as preaching, as proclamation. Thank God for the Lutherans, they knew that. Need some recovery. So there are other things that I think could be included under what we call happy teaching moments. Happy teaching moments. I think the liturgy, in some cases, I get into a lot of different traditions, is starved because there's no good teaching. And that's a point I made earlier. I call that, there can be a paraliturgical teaching moment that sometimes is clearly comes out to be very prayerful. And very energizing. Where you're doing some teaching, and the teaching suddenly emerges into praying. and the praying and the singing and the singing and the blessing. It can happen. I said, it could happen. Now, that's all I wanted to lay out. Just some things about when we start talking about emotion, we have to be careful of cultural issues, but also on the nature of what Christian emotion is. And it's for the long haul, and it's really for the way we live, not just the way we feel.
In the last 13 months since I've been out of the full-time ministry, we have potentially visited countless churches in West Michigan to, for one thing, get a better handle on worship in churches across denominational lines. And we are just short of a good deal of delusion and dissatisfaction and grief over the health of worship, again, across denominational lines. And it occurred to me as we have been speaking about these five emotions, capacities for emotion and expression, that they are and ought also to be values, worship values, that we hold high. And in that sense, they are not shallow feelings. They are deep feelings and expressions of maturity in relationship with Christ and one another. And the sadness of my heart is, as I think about this, is that many worship leaders are not thinking about these kinds of feelings. And if they are, there is no teaching that is connected with it. And particularly in the services, the so-called contemporary, many churches will offer a traditional service and a contemporary, and we have visited both to see what's happening. And you get the music set for X number of minutes, some announcements, the pastor will speak, and then a goodbye, see you next week kind of format. And unless these values are inherent in the music, in the set, you have to kind of hunt for them, and many times delightfully be surprised by them, which wasn't nice. But I'm grieved by the lack of intentionality that is happening in many of our churches. Surely not in our churches led by IWS students and graduates. But I'm fearful to some degree there as well, because we all are fighting against not an acquaintance with culture, but an absolute immersion in culture that wants the immediate and the shallow. And as much as we can embrace these ourselves as we sit around these tables and talk about this, it is not easy to generate this in the context of worship, traditional, liturgical, contemporary, or free. It takes real intentionality.
It does. And finally, you know, we really, this is a gift of the Spirit. This is the paradox of Christian leadership, isn't it? That the best we can do is set the conditions under which the Spirit may enable people and ourselves to grow, to deepen. I wish there were a more direct way, but I think this has been God's way from the beginning. This awesome freedom that the creation has and that the creatures have, and yet the constant invitation, return, come to me, come and see, too. But when certain things are found together, the conditions are better. and some of those have to do, I think, with the ecology, if I may say so. That would be, you know, planning over a year's period, thinking through the whole year, and if you are interested in following in detail the church here, there are ample opportunities as to how things are always being refreshed. So one interesting way is to think of that whole old-fashioned, I'm sure you learned it here, of the relationship between the so-called ordinaries and the property, the propers, that is, that's fancy language for what's fixed and what's variable. And as you pass through time, the Eucharist itself is, okay, I'm being visited with an image, and this is probably not mine. It's like turning a diamond in the light, there are infinite number of facets of Christ, infinite number of facets of God. And as you turn it through time, now this facet, now this facet, but only in turning it over time do you come to understand what the Eucharist means. In times of sorrow, in the times of joy, in times of indifference, in times of grief, in the times of passage, in the times of a lot of fighting in the church, in times of world events that change everything for you, and you start crying out the Lord's Prayer, you don't mumble it anymore. So I'm a big believer in the fact that we've got to keep turning this relationship between time and the gospel and the scriptures in our life through time. Now, in an impatient society, that's difficult. I want to see that happen. Hey, preacher, that's going to happen. If you can do that in the next six weeks, we'll up your salary. I mean, that's awful. But the other side of what you're saying is so important, because I think if good teaching and good fellowship and good prayer go together with breaking bread. Oh, Lord, I didn't make that up. That's Acts 2:42. You know, if those things are found together interanimating one another, then I say the conditions for the Spirit to work are enhanced. And that sense is a kind of synergy that we're to be cooperative with God's characteristic modes of grace. And I think there are characteristic ways in which our God operates, and I think in a congregation's life, those four elements that were there at the very beginning, you know, of teaching in the apostolic way, the witness of the apostles and the martyrs. I would add a few more in there: the fellowship, the caring, the loving for one another, the breaking of the bread. You know, in the prayers, those four things right there could be a charter for what we might call optimal conditions for the Spirit to work. I haven't put it that way. Thank you. I'm going to write that down. See if that'll work. But I do think that there are ways in which, now, some of you are in churches that inherit already histories of grumbling. You know, long histories of refractory sort of attitudes. Long histories of being dominated by one or two outer joint folk. I remember in that small rural parish, I had heard tales by the pastor who came before me. He said, stay away from the so-so family. Or, you know, cater to the so-so family. They're in control of the purse strings and so on. Well, I must have been innocent of that, because I made their acquaintance and found that they had suffering and they were as complicated as anyone else. And if you touched that need, then a lot of the history of their dominance was moderated. I didn't say I solved it. I was telling you the story about the grief in that congregation. I think I ought to share that now, because that's about this topic. When I came to that church, I was very young, very innocent, I don't know how it was, but there it was. I started as a supply pastor. That's a little Methodist talk for someone who doesn't have any education, who's forced to do ministry. But I detected in this congregation a kind of melancholy, kind of a sadness. And I first attributed it to the fact that they were all of German descent. like sad Danes and happy Danes, or these are sad Germans. But it was deeper than that. It was deeper than that, because it issued in committee inability to make decisions. You know, kind of paralysis about this. Well, I don't know. Do that. You just preach, and you know the story. Until Jim Anderson, one of the laypersons in the church, one Sunday night over tomato soup and cheese sandwich, I can still taste the burnt cheese sandwich, said, empty an unguarded railroad crossing and a carload of teenagers, and we lost. And suddenly, I don't think I had the psychological or spiritual maturity to do something with that right now, but suddenly, everything clicked. Those folks had not finished grieving over these lost teenagers from God knows how many years ago. And I say that because that tells us something about the character of a difficult emotion that had gripped that community, and unresolved grief, unresolved anger, unresolved what? Now, if I only had hindsight, if I only could have sort of thought it through, I think I could have done some things liturgically that might have helped. How we prayed, what we sang, even boldly enough, like you took that risk of preaching on grief. I don't think I could have done it. I wasn't wise enough. I suppose I could a little better now than I've loved and lost, and know what it is when communities have lost. But that's another side of this whole story, of discerning this pattern of formation that's there, or something that's suppressed and is affecting many, many things. And then allowing the grace of Christ and the work of the Spirit to invade, to be vulnerable enough and honest enough, and sometimes, to use an old Jewish term, have enough chutzpah to go right straight. We have a saying in my particular family, the way through is straight through. And that's been painful sometimes. But I think that is what's called for here. All of that is by way of shared pastoral stuff that we all know. When we talk about liturgy, we're also talking about the formation of the spiritual life of the Christian life. And when we talk about the Christian life, then we're also talking about what people can bring to worship. That, too, is another part of the work. What are you bringing to worship? Do you expect Jesus to show up? It's kind of embarrassing, is it? You know, he promised he was going to do this. Oh, but not the whole Jesus, not everything that you saw on those cross crucifixions, not all that stuff. Give me a little bit of what I can take in. Okay, right, there's something for everybody. I want to end with a litany, and then I have copies of it, but I don't want you to have the copy because it's not as good when you don't do it spontaneously. So we're going to talk a little bit about specific prayer forms and sing in some prayer forms tomorrow. But a litany is a great, great useful thing. Just like our wonderful dancer this morning said, these are tools, he says. I could use a little different metaphor, but anyway, these are tools for praise. Well, the litany is sometimes a neglected thing in our tradition, and especially for free church folk. Because in the black churches, the preaching has litanic forms in it that really work. How long? This long. How long? I mean, this principle of rhetorical repetition that deepens as you go. So here's what you are going to say to God. Okay? I'll give you this much of it. I will impress you this much. You are to say these words. No. But I haven't time, Lord. But I haven't time. That's what you're supposed to say. All right?
But I haven't time, Lord.
I'd like to walk under the open sky long enough to let rain down on me and the sun warm my face.
But I haven't time, Lord. I haven't time.
I'd like to be attentive to the song of birds and of all creatures hymning the world to you.
But I haven't time, Lord. I haven't time.
I'd like to have 8 full glorious hours of sleep to wake refreshed and with joy in the morning.
But I haven't time, Lord.
I'd like to visit those who are ill, confined, who need a smile and a touch of the human hand.
But I haven't time, Lord. I haven't time.
I'd like to bring healing and peace to the imprisoned, to the stranger, to the dying.
But I haven't time, Lord. I haven't time.
I'd like to write a long letter to my friends and my family, telling each how life is with me and thanking them just for being.
But I haven't time, Lord. I haven't time.
I'd like to be still one evening, long enough to see the subtle change from light to dark and all the deepening hues of nightfall.
But I haven't time, Lord. I haven't time.
I'd like to praise you for all that we've been given with all the breath within me.
But I haven't time, Lord. I haven't time.
Take from us the burden of rushing through our lifetimes. Redeem the time with us, in us, through us. And we say our times are in your hand. Our times are in your hand. Amen.